Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Gubbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
Over the past 2 weeks, we had the pleasure of having Ralph Ellis on the show. And Ralph educated us on all things Egypt, specifically the connections between the Bible and how those things fit into ancient Egyptian history. Now, last week, he went into the story of how people like Mary Magdalene and Jesus have very strong connections to ancient Egypt. And Kathleen's book, of course, The Expected One, goes into the story as to how Mary Magdalene leaves the Holy Land just after the moment of the crucifixion, goes to Alexandria, and afterwards ends up in France. And that is also some of the trajectory which we're going to focus on in this episode of The Spirit Revolution. But first we are going to Egypt, because for those people who have been watching the History Channel is once again up to its bizarre antics with a documentary called Chasing Mummies, or as it should be called, Chasing Zahi Hawass. Zahi Hawass is the director of antiquities. He had this promotion several years ago when he upgraded, got a promotion from being the director of the Giza Plateau. And he is a very controversial person. It's fair to say that there is not a single documentary on ancient Egypt which excludes the man, and this is a documentary specifically about the man. And in Chasing Mummies, we follow Zahi Hawass in his daily endeavors to do various things in Egypt, whether it is entering pyramids, whether it is opening other things. And in the third episode, which is airing this week, he is going to Alexandria and actually going to be involved in underwater archaeology. Now, the interesting thing about this documentary is that Hawass is known to have often staged some of his documentaries with bogus revelations. But this documentary is worse than most, because, Kathleen, you have been doing some digging, and you found some interesting aspects about who some of these people are who appear on air with Zahi.
Well, first of all, I want to say that, you know, your introduction and the way that you talk about this show makes it sound so interesting and so exciting and like a show that we all really would want to watch and find informative. Certainly the next episode, they're going to be digging in Alexandria and underwater. These are all things we should really care about and should be great, great fun and highly educational. However, the producers of this show have instead chosen to keep their focus on Zahi's antics, his temperament, his minute-by-minute explosions, his utter and complete and total abuse of the people who work for him, from the 30,000 people in Egypt who work on the excavation sites to these, quote, interns. Much of the first two episodes were spent watching Zahi abuse interns. Now, I was suspicious from the very beginning when I listened to some of the questions that these interns were asking. I mean, we see very clearly in the first episode that a girl shows up at the excavation site. Never mind that she gets past the security of the excavation site and the security of the producers and, you know, the security around the set. She shows up with no credentials and says, oh, I'm the intern, and she's not the one on the list, okay? They're looking for someone named Claire who they know, they have her educational background, or so they say. And instead, this very, very, very pretty little thing named Zoe shows up and says, oh, no, I'm the one, and they let her in. And kind of the adventures of Zoe's complete and utter ineptness becomes a big piece of this. Now, I'm thinking to myself as I'm watching the three interns who are involved in this mess, there is no way that any of these kids have any archaeological training, because the questions they're asking are so patently ridiculous that no real student who really cared deeply about this information, who was there, whatever you think of Zahi Hawass, to have the opportunity to be his intern from an American college is a big deal. And you would not be chosen for that position based on your scholarly aptitudes unless you were really, really good at this and experienced, at least from the point of view of being book learned, I would suspect. But instead we have questions like, well, didn't the ancient Egyptians have slaves? What about the Jewish people? Weren't they slaves? I mean, we're talking about sixth grade archaeology questions. I mean, there is one moment in the second episode where the male intern, I believe his name is Derek, actually says to Zahi, as they're in the middle of the Great Pyramid, wow, aliens might have built this. I mean, at which point I think I screamed, really? Are we really going to go down this highly scripted, totally inane path? And so that's when I started digging. And that's when I discovered that the lovely, inept Zoe is a model and an actress. Lindsay, the other one, who actually sometimes looks like she might be real, so that just means she's the best actress, has an IMD profile and has movie background. So, you know, the so-called interns are, in fact, actors who have been hired to goad Zahi to ask stupid questions so that we can see his legendary temper. And so what happens is he rants, he raves, he screams, he says you will be punished. You know, he tells Zoe that she needs to go work in a supermarket, and she probably does, actually, based on what happens in the episode. She certainly doesn't belong in archaeology, but the point is she never did, and she's not an archaeologist. So you just kind of get to the point where it all feels like, if, to me, it feels like an MTV reality show. It's sort of that ridiculous. It's that scripted. It's very, very silly, although I also find it a little bit disturbing, because I do think that as scripted as it is, that Zahi at times really appears to be kind of unhinged in the way that he is so incredibly abusive to everybody.
Yes, I mean, you know, it definitely looks like a reality TV show, but like all reality TV shows, they are scripted. But what is different from all the other documentaries is that for years, Hawass has been able to profile himself as very much, strict and very much controlled, whereas when the cameras are off, or when there are no cameras around, and in his, you know, in his life, that's about 5 seconds every day, he just completely loses it, and people know that. There's a professor of Egyptology who I met a few years ago, who just before flying over to where we were meeting, I asked him the question, kind of said, like, you know, have you had any recent contact with Zahi Hawass? And he said, yes, just before flying out, I had a meeting with him. And I said, how did it go? And he said, well, you know, he shouted at me and I shouted at him. And that is very much the way Hawass performs. He's a bully, not just with women, but with everybody. He tries to keep fellow professors who have much higher scientific credentials than he has at kind of, you know, wherever he can keep them at. It's known that if it wasn't for Egyptian Culture Minister Farouk Hosni, Hawass would have been thrown out, if not in jail, several years ago. So this is a very controversial man. This is a man who is a bully, who is a dictator. And what I like about this TV show is that actually it exposes the real Hawass. And the fact that I don't know why they did it. I don't know why it was just that History Channel is just doing it because it's good TV. I don't know whether Hawass realizes it's all fabricated. I actually don't think he does. And kind of like, you know, whoever the producers were, if they did it with a possibility to actually expose Hawass's stupidity and the way he goes about things, that might actually be a good thing, because a lot of the reasons why Hawass stays in his position in ancient Egypt is because he can show to people in Egypt how well he is represented and how well he carries out Egypt's image and how well he does all of these things. And if anything, this show definitely doesn't show the way Hawass wants to portray himself, and definitely doesn't show an Egyptian the way Egyptians want to be perceived across the world.
Well, one of the things that you see very clearly, and this is one of the many things about this series that I find disturbing, one of the things that you see very clearly is we're not seeing history. We're not seeing discoveries. We're not learning anything. What we are doing is we are being spoon-fed exactly what Zahi Hawass wants us to know and or believe. There is no progress being made here. There is nothing happening that is going to give us any further insight into what the ancient Egyptians were about, because we are not getting anything new. We are only getting, Zahi Hawass has made it very clear in his work elsewhere, as well as watching him here on this show, that he has one agenda, and his agenda is to perpetuate this singular version of Egyptology. Okay, everything is exactly the way the books say it. The pyramids were built as tombs. They were built by these specific pharaoh. We are not allowed to look at it in any other way. And he is clearly committed to making sure that there are no progressive opinions presented. So for me, what I see as I watch it is it just looks like a sort of giant, ugly PR exercise. In action. But, you know, I know that you were surprised that Zahi was going to allow himself to be seen in this way, because he had sort of carefully cultivated his image. And I don't know if he's just completely lost it now, and he's so arrogant and so narcissistic that he doesn't care. But I will say there is one thing, you know, the History Channel, if you've listened to this show before, and if you've listened to it regularly, you know that the History Channel and I have a very rough relationship. I find them incredibly disappointing. Most of the time, there is no history on the History Channel. I do not love their slate of shows, which is things like Pawn Stars and Trash Pickers. I think it's a testosterone-driven, very shallow agenda that is currently running the History Channel. Now, periodically, they do something lovely and surprise me, and I was hoping that this might be something really, truly about history again, but it's not. It's that trashy, sensationalist, tabloid agenda. And the element of the show that really made this clear to me is in the first episode, the tragically inept Zoe gets trapped in a pyramid along with a cameraman, ostensibly for 5+ hours. This is what we're told. They get left behind in this tomb and locked in, and nobody knows that this has happened. Now, aside from all that feeling very staged and pretty impossible, let's just say for a minute that it did happen. The point of the danger here, the thing that I really object to, is there is a moment when they are interviewing Zahi Hawass on the way to get to this tomb to let these people out, and the producer says to him, you know, they could be dead in there. And he says, yeah, why not? Maybe they could be. And it's this cavalier attitude that he has. He doesn't care if this intern and this cameraman are dead, or it's so staged he knows that they're not. But even if it is, this idea that those people could have died in there, it's incidental to him. You know, if anything, it's going to contaminate his site and create some kind of paperwork he has to do and be unhappy about. So, there is this complete disregard for any element of humanity in the history here. I find it entirely objectionable, I think it's a travesty. I think the History Channel once again should be ashamed of itself.
And with that, we probably leave Egypt and we go into the footsteps of Mary Magdalene, because before we interviewed Ralph, we had our report from France, and in France we said we were going to come back to the fact that we also were in the footsteps of Mary Magdalene and various other people there. And for last week, on July 22nd, we celebrated the special day, the feast day of Mary Magdalene. And on my website, which is philipcoppens.com, and I probably better spell that, PHILIPCOPPENS, and we'll link to it from the Spirit Revolution website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. I uploaded an article in the footsteps of the Three Marys. Kathleen, of course, has done extensive writing on Mary Magdalene and everybody else from the first family of Christianity and how they ended up in France. But we want to kind of like go into how we kind of like went beyond the books, so to speak, which is the story of Kathleen. And it's also something which is kind of like what archaeology should be about. When you listen to Zahi Hawass, he will kind of like tell you that it's very dangerous, and you have this idea that archaeologists are always out there in the open, going into a desert where there's nothing to be seen, and with a shovel and a spade and various other things, and just start digging, and oh my God, they find things. But archaeology specifically, Egyptology as well, is very much conforming to the books. If there is no such thing in the books, then there is no such thing to be done. And even if you find something in the field, there's still this idea that it has to conform to the big picture. So the entire question of Mary Magdalene in France and everybody else in France is already kind of against what anything is supposed to be about in the Bible, because in the Bible there's nothing to be said for her being in France.
Well, the Bible doesn't say a lot of things. And if we are looking to the Bible as our only source of information, we have very little to go on. I hear this all the time. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. From the Bible doesn't say she had red hair, to the Bible doesn't say any of these things about her, to the Bible doesn't say she was married to Jesus. The Bible doesn't say much. But what most people don't realize is the Bible was not intended to be a biography of anything. And that's this, you know, we have to look at what the Bible is and what the Bible represents. And, you know, my point of view on this is that the Gospels, for the most part, are a very beautiful, literate version of lecture notes. The Bible are Jesus's lecture notes. This is what he taught. Some of the Gospels have some introduction, who he was and why he was, but mostly it's this is what he taught and this is what he said. The Bible that I have here on my desk, I have many of them. I think the longest version of the Gospel of John in any of them is 15 pages. You know, and I think that sometimes you have to look at it that pragmatically. Those 15 pages are not meant to be a complete biography of the most, of arguably the most complex man who has lived in the last 2,000 years, if not in human history. 15 pages is not meant to cover everything. It's not meant to cover his personal life. It's not meant to cover details. By the way, it doesn't say what color Jesus' hair is either. It doesn't say a lot. You know, we don't, it doesn't talk about where he was as a child overall. You know, I could spend the next hour talking about all the things the Bible doesn't say. So that becomes the big question for those of us who care to know more is, if the Bible doesn't say it, where do we go? Where, you know, where do we find the information, and how do we go beyond the books? Of course, academia wants to look at verifiable documentation. I understand that. I respect it to a degree. I think that the problem with history is that what has been accepted as documentary evidence of history is so limited and so narrow, and I've said this a million times, it teaches us nothing about the truth of these characters or their deeds, because history is written by the winners. So what is left for us to read as authenticated document is somebody's intention, somebody's agenda. Here is what I want you to know. And 2,000 years ago, if I'm writing it down, it means I'm educated. It means I have access to ink and paper. It means I'm wealthy. So you're going to get my point of view. So I have entered into this world of history over the last 20 years from the point of view that I don't trust most of what is written down. I find the authenticated material suspect. I actually am kind of the anti-academic, I would say, in that point of view. And that's kind of a scarlet letter, and I get a lot of abuse for that from the scholars. And I'm okay with that. I didn't used to be, but I grew into being okay with that, because by definition, I am in opposition to who they are and what they teach. Because while I do my due diligence, I read everything academically that's written about my subjects. It's the information that I gain from going outside of the books that I think really teaches me something.
And it's that kind of aspect, I think, which is what you need to delve into the Mary Magdalene in France, because when you look at it from a History Channel documentary perspective, and what you get about Mary Magdalene in France is this story quite often, which is actually specifically inaccurate, that Mary Magdalene somehow landed in Saint Marie de la Mer, and she lived there for a few years, and that from there on a bloodline evolved, which somehow mixed into or became the Merovingian bloodline, and then we are, from there on, various other theories abound. Now, I had been to Sainte-Marie-la-Mer before, but it was the first time I went to the Gypsy Festival this year. And by something by design and somewhat by accident, we ended up visiting an awful lot of Mary Magdalene and related sites. So we went to Saint Baume, we went to Tarascon, and we obviously went to Rennes-le-Château. And in all of these places, you find specific references to Mary Magdalene. And what I found, and we also went to Vézelay. And what I found was that in this, you know, in these 5-6 sites visited in less than 2 weeks, and reading about the available literature and what you see, is that you get a very harmonious picture emerging from all of these sites. And it's not just about Mary Magdalene, but it's also about Martha, her sister, it's about Lazarus, it's about the Marys which are worshipped in Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, and you get a very homogeneous picture of what happened. And for me, the killer, the clincher of it all, was this something which I actually only read in the book, in a book when I got back home, which was that when you go into Saint Baume, it's twinned with Saint Maximin, or it's not really twinned, it's part of the same town. And in Saint Maximin, you have the skull of Mary Magdalene. And it was, I think in the 1970s, subjected to scientific testing. Now, the story of this, of all of these relics, whether it's Martha in Tarascon, and we'll come back to some of these details, but basically what happened is this. There is a legend locally in all of these places, Martha in Tarascon, Mary Magdalene in St. Baume, that the saints have lived there. And then in medieval times, people begin to dig. In Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, for example, it's the famous René d'Anjou who starts digging. And they find bones. Now, all the skeptics will say, ah, but these are medieval times. There was a tremendous, you know, trade in relics. If you didn't have a relic, it meant that there were no pilgrims coming. This is all medieval tourist trade, and it's all a fake, because we know that John the Baptist has 15 right index fingers and about 25 detached heads. So why would the bones of Mary Magdalene and anybody else's be any different? And so we are led to believe that René d'Anjou and all of the other kings who dug for these relics were either stupid, too believable, or were somehow involved in creating fake relics that they actually knew. And it sounds a bit like Zai Hawass. But then, you know, some of these relics have been tested, some of them haven't been. But the one in St. Maximin was tested. And what they found using carbon-14 and various other dating techniques and analysis techniques was this. First of all, the skull is that of a woman. Okay, that's not so dramatic. It's a woman from the first century, however. She was of the right age, in her 50s, potentially early 60s. She was rather small. And then you begin to wonder, this is quite interesting, that of what we know about Mary Magdalene and what she's supposed to have been outside of the books, a medieval faker got right. In a situation whereby you probably wouldn't expect it to find. If, you know, let's face it, nobody, it's a bit like with the Shroud of Turin. When the Shroud of Turin was found in the 15th century and went on exhibition, only a small part of it was actually shown, and only some of the detail, which kind of like makes it so complex, the 3D aspect, the fact that it is truly a supernatural, unexplained means through which the image was made into the material. All of these things really only came about hundreds of years later. Between Mary Magdalene's bones being found in roughly 1200 until the 1970s is almost a millennium, whereby nobody really cared or could find out what this relic was all about. And nobody would even think that there's ever going to be such a thing as a carbon dating technique in those days, which might prove or invalidate the fact that some skull which they have used as a fake, you know, nobody enters that mind. So all of this, a very long-winded way of saying, basically that kind of confirmation of the fact that it is a woman, it is from the first century, of the right age, of the right height, is extremely powerful evidence that we have found the bones, the skull of Mary Magdalene, irrelevant of the fact that there isn't a little plaque saying these are the bones of Mary Magdalene sitting next to it. So that to me was really the clincher material that actually the first analysis to be performed on anything to do with the entire French legend, so to speak, of Mary Magdalene, and it comes back with this overpowering evidence that actually it is all true.
Well, the other thing about the Magdalene relics, specifically the ones in Vézelay and Saint-Baume, the Vézelay story is a little bit different because relics have come and gone from Vézelay. In fact, what most people don't realize, particularly people who maybe have just come to this story via the Da Vinci Code and they actually still believe that potentially Mary Magdalene's bones are buried under the Mall in the Louvre or something crazy like that. Magdalene's bones have been accounted for about 1,600 years. And this is the idea that Mary Magdalene's bones were discovered and revered and were the subject of great devotion throughout France is something that predates all of this medieval hysteria over relics. And predates it significantly by centuries. So that's the other thing you have to look at. You have to look at the fact that since about the 4th century, we have known where these bones are, where they were discovered. The sarcophagus is, or sarcophagi?
I think both are right.
The sarcophagi, the three sarcophagi that were originally discovered in St. Maximin, are all early. So there, anyway, there is this great evidence that these bones have been accounted for, revered for a very, very long time, arguably longer than any others, with the exception of St. Martha. And we'll segue into that for a minute, too. St. Martha in Tarascon is such a powerful, powerful presence. The legend, of course, is that Martha accompanied Mary Magdalene, her sister or sister-in-law, depending on which version of the story you believe. I happen to believe that Martha was her sister-in-law and that Martha was married to Lazarus, who was the brother of Mary Magdalene. However you believe their relationship to be, the legend says all of them showed up in this same boat and landed on the shores of France together. The relics of Lazarus, Martha, and Mary Magdalene have all been extremely important in French history for 2,000 years. Lazarus's are a little trickier. He was sort of dispersed all over France, and we don't really know exactly, you know, which ones are authentic and where they are. But Martha's have always been in the same place and accounted for, and they are in the town of Tarascon, which is in Provence. It's about 40-45 miles outside of Saint-Marie-la-Mer. Extraordinary town on the Rhone River, very beautiful. René d'Anjou had a castle there, coincidentally or not. The legends of Martha in France are very, very powerful. Martha's a really, really important character. More so once she arrives in France. When Martha arrives in France, she becomes one of the great early heroes. And I think that's interesting because this is a very different Martha than the Martha we see in the Bible. The Martha that we see in the Bible is the very sort of fussy caretaker who's, you know, in the kitchen and cooking and making sure everyone's doing what they're supposed to be and chastising Mary Magdalene for not doing those things. The Martha we see in France is a hero. The Martha we see in France is the one who actually wrestles with the monster that is terrorizing her people. The town of Tarascon gets its name from a creature called the Tarasca, and the Tarasca is a type of sea monster, kind of like a dragon who lives in the river, and the legend says that the Tarasca would swim up the Rhone and eat people. and that nothing that could be done would slay the Tarasca. And you know, those of you who are listening to this are probably going to start hearing the similarities and the metaphors to Saint George, and of course the different versions of what the Tarasca could be, and the metaphors of the dragon and paganism, that kind of thing. But the legend is that it is Martha who takes on the Tarasca, and that it is only Martha who is able to achieve peace in Tarascon through the way that she deals with the Tarasca. But what's interesting is that Martha doesn't slay the Tarasca. This is not a woman who kills the monster. Instead, she charms it. She tames it. Her iconography shows her with a pail of holy water. And there are various versions of the legend. One of them is that she pours the holy water on the Tarasca, and then the Tarasca is tamed. And we noticed in our time in Tarascon this year, it was my second trip there, that all these images, and the older you go, the farther back you go to the iconography, you see the Tarasca lying at Martha's feet, kind of like a very tame dog. And so I think that there is a sort of a really beautiful version of the legend going on here in the iconography, which is that it's really a love conquers all kind of thing. Martha doesn't kill the opposition. She tames it with love. Very powerful, very, very beautiful story. But her church in Tarascon, incredible place, in the crypt, her remains were found there, also verified, first century sarcophagus. So again, we have all of this extraordinary archaeological evidence that these women did come to France and did do extraordinary things and were revered for them. And I want to say that when my first book came out, The Expected One, about Mary Magdalene in France, and I had a lot of publicity, a lot of national publicity, USA Today put me on the front page, and every time they ran an interview with me, they always closed with some biblical scholar or another, usual suspects. It's usually Bart Ehrman or Marvin Meyer, because those are the boys from the boys' club who like to be the ones who discredit research like mine. And they're always there at the end saying, there's no proof that Mary Magdalene was even in France. And as I am fond of saying, there is no proof that Mary Magdalene was in France if you're in a library in North Carolina. But when you go to France, there is all kinds of proof. There are thousands of sites where she is present. There are relics, not just of her, but of her brother, of Martha, of the other Marys. You talked about René d'Anjou digging in Sainte-Marie de la Mer. Well, what René discovers is he discovers the sarcophagi of two of the Marys, Mary Jacobée, Mary Salomé, the Marys who were arguably related to the Virgin Mary and who were also present with Mary Magdalene at the foot of the cross. The Sainte-Marie de la Mer, the Saint Marys of the Sea, is actually named after those Marys. I often hear from people that it's Mary Magdalene and the Virgin Mary. It's not. It's actually the Saint Marys of the Sea refers to Mary Jacobée, Mary Salomé, because they are the remains, they are the relics that were found there in Sainte-Marie de la Mer.
Yes, and when you start piecing all the various legends together, from whether they are from Marseille or from Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, the image you get is that apparently some people came from the Holy Land to France roughly in 50 AD, and that amongst them wasn't yet Mary Magdalene, that she somehow seems to have come on a later trip. And when you piece the stories together, it's that she went to Marseille, that she spent some time with Lazarus there, that she apparently preached to the poor, and then she retired to Saint-Baume. And this is where I found it interesting that some of these legends, when you listen to a legend of Martha in Tarascon or the legend of Mary Magdalene in Saint-Baume, that they actually overlap, because the story goes that when she came to Saint-Baume, she chased the dragon, the Tarascon, away out of the cave where she was going to live in by invoking Saint Michael. And then you go to Tarascon and you find out that all of a sudden the Tarasque is there, and it's her sister or sister-in-law, Martha, who kind of like, you know, does the final act, so to speak. And it's all of this intricate overlapping, which I found extremely interesting. The fact that Martha originally lived in Avignon, I found extremely interesting as well, and that she only came to Terrascon when she was invited by the people of that town to help them with the problem of the monster which was causing havoc in that town. And then, of course, you have the entire the papal schism when it happened in medieval times. Avignon became the seat where the anti-popes were going to rule from. And you begin to wonder, you know, like, is this a coincidence or not? And just going back to that archaeology aspect, I think it's in Terrascon, but I think it's also in some other places where they actually began to dig, when they started to make either extensions or reparations or just archaeological digs, that they found that the legend was that Martha was buried there in the house where she had lived, where she was preaching, and they actually found remains from walls from a small house on that site, dating from roughly that era. So it's this entire sequence of archaeology, and you can. It's not just a legend that Mary Magdalene arrived somehow on a boat and almost like a ghost floated around the countryside and then completely disappeared into a puff of smoke, which archaeologists can say, well, you know, how do we prove that or how do we disprove that? It really is like making close your eyes and pretend all of this archaeological evidence isn't there, and that you have, as you said, you know, 1500 years of historical and archaeological accounts which show that something was there, that in 600, 700, 800 AD there were accounts of how bones were found and were reburied, and that there is this sequence of events that that there were hermits and other monks settling on certain places extremely early on in the 4th century, and that already there was this connection that Mary Magdalene had been in St. Bone. There's an extraordinary amount of material out there, and it baffles belief, but then I shouldn't be surprised that archaeologists and historians simply treat that with utter disdain and pretend it's not there.
Well, again, I go back to this idea, American historians, American biblical scholars, you know, for me, are the greatest sinners when it comes to this, because they absolutely show no interest in investigating these other areas of information, and because they write them all off as legend, and therefore say that it's unimportant. And you know, to them, I say this: if we really care about getting to the heart of who these people were, if we really care about knowing who these people were, what motivated them and what they did, why aren't we looking at all aspects of who they were? You know, I'm always fond of saying, look, Mary Magdalene didn't have a passport and it wasn't stamped and we didn't find it in a dig somewhere saying she arrived in France on this day. Not going to happen. You know, she was, you know, again, by definition, by her nature, why she was there, she was an exile. She was escaping. She was escaping a horrible situation. She was protecting her family and her friends and herself. She's not going to leave a lot of traces. So what is left is legend. But the fact that the legend and the cultural traditions and the folkloric traditions are so powerful and have endured for 2,000 years tells us something extremely important. Now, you can also argue that it you know, it's archetypal. I had this discussion with a Jungian recently who said, oh, none of it's real. It's all archetypes, and it's just our need to, you know, project the archetypes, and we've invented all this. But to your point, Philip, there is so much archaeological evidence. There are bones. There are sarcophagi. There are houses. There are inscriptions. There's all this information that leads us to a very interesting mosaic of history. Now, where it becomes complicated is this idea of conflation. Conflation is the great obstacle in understanding any of the Magdalene stuff, because she is conflated with so many people. I mean, whether we start with the biblical conflation, and by conflation I mean this idea of stories of multiple people that get blended together into one person, right? So We have the problem of Gregory the Great in the 6th century saying that Mary Magdalene is the unknown sinner in Luke's gospel, therefore conflating her with this other character, that, you know, all these things that happen. But then what happens later on historically, and I see this even today, even today on Facebook, I see it all the time, where people start, there's this trend in Magdalene mania to make everything Mary Magdalene. All these paintings are Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene is every Madonna ever painted. All of these women with red hair are Mary Magdalene. In some cases, that's true, but you have to remember that there are hundreds of women who, over the last 2,000 years, who are descendants of this lineage. Whether it's the blood lineage or the spiritual lineage, there are a lot of Magdalenes, a lot of them. Remember that Magdalene is essentially a title. Okay, so whereas Mary Magdalene is our original queen, she is Notre Dame, she's not the only one. There is a whole line of extraordinary women who descend from her. When we look at all the legends of Mary Magdalene from the first century, there is no possible way that any one human could have done all of these things. Clearly, some of these are conflations. They are other women, either her daughter or her grandchildren or other women in the line or other Marys who were doing the same thing, who had the same mission, who were teaching the way, who were ministering, who were preaching, and it all ultimately sort of becomes Mary Magdalene. And that's where it becomes a little bit tricky, because we don't always know how to separate out these issues. And also because the daughter, who becomes a really important character, is also by nature someone who has to be protected. So her identity becomes a big question. Where does she show up? Why doesn't she show up? Well, she does show up. She shows up in the iconography of St. Barbara, and all these other ways. But Mary Magdalene herself could not have been in all these places. And when you spend a lot of time in Sainte Marie de la Mer, I think I've been there now 6 times, and I have spent significant time digging around that town over the last years. And what you realize is that these other Marys are extremely important characters. That Saint Sarah, who the gypsies come to celebrate every year on May 25th, is an extremely important character. Now, a lot, again, since the Da Vinci Code and all sort of the modern mythology, a lot of people believe that this Saint Sarah, whose bones were found with the Marys in Sainte Marie de la Mer, this Saint Sarah, who is the patroness of the gypsies, a lot of people now say, oh, this is the daughter of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And I actually don't believe that. And people are usually very surprised to hear me say, oh, no, I don't believe that at all. I do not. I believe that this Saint Sarah, who is celebrated every year and who I go as well to celebrate, is someone who traveled with them. But I believe this is where we get into the ideas of Sarah the Egyptian, Sarah the Gypsy Queen. This is not the daughter. I believe that this is Sarah who came to them from Alexandria, who may have been the midwife who delivered Mary Magdalene's son. But she was certainly an important character, and a character who had some kind of training in mystery school. She was likely a priestess. But when you start interviewing the gypsies at Sainte Marie de la Mer, you find a very different story. The Sarah, who the gypsies revere, is an extraordinary character who deserves to be celebrated separately for who she is outside of the Holy Family story. And I sometimes think that in our enthusiasm to restore Mary Magdalene to her rightful place, that we sometimes erase or minimize the importance of all these other characters. And I think she, of all people, would not want us to do that. I think if she were here, she would want us to recognize all of these people for their greatness and their nobility. Certainly the gypsies recognize Sarah as the patron saint of the traveling people, because there is a beautiful legend that she essentially established what would be the first homeless shelter on the shores of this village. And the idea comes from this story. In the first century, if you were exiled by Caesar, you had to go a certain number of Roman miles outside of Rome. And I believe it was roughly 400. I can't remember the exact number. But Sainte Marie de la Mer represented a location that was right outside of the exile place. So people who were exiled, who leave Rome with nothing but what's on their backs, end up in this location. This is a place where they can stop and rebuild their lives. And that it is actually Sarah who, when she lands there, begins to create what is essentially a shelter where for feeding people and clothing people and helping them to get back on their feet while they are in exile. And it's as a result of this that she becomes the patroness of the traveling people. She is the one who cares for those who have nowhere to go or have no permanent home. And that's how she becomes the patroness of the gypsies. This is such a beautiful story. This is such an incredible character who deserves to be celebrated for who she is. So I don't want to see this Sarah character become diminished by making her into something that she's not. And I also don't want to step on the extraordinarily beautiful and powerful traditions of the spirituality of the Gitan, the gypsy people, by trying to make their Sarah into something that she's not. So I think we have to be really careful when we start retelling these stories. And I think we have to be really diligent about getting as close to the source as possible. And in this case, not just saying, okay, well, her name is Sarah, and, you know, Margaret Starbird and Dan Brown say that the daughter's name was Sarah, so therefore this is the daughter of Jesus. I think that's very dangerous.
And I think one of the other things is kind of like two aspects. One of them is, as people know who've seen Gladiator, the lead character is supposed to have come from Spain. And all of this thing is that indeed, for people who've gone to Europe and to France and the region around Saint-Marie-de-la-Mer, there are Roman highways everywhere because there was this united Europe around the Mediterranean, which included the Holy Land. It wasn't just Egypt, Israel, France, Spain the way it is right now, but it was basically the Roman Empire. And one other thing is, which I think is very interesting, is the stories about Claudia Procula, how she was from France, and specifically the Pontius Pilate connection just south of Lyon, which is, again, a very central place, Marseille, where Lazarus went to and where St. Baume is very close to Lyon. And it's this one legend goes that Pontius Pilate is from the Pilate, if you pronounce it in the English way, or Pila, if you pronounce it in the French way, which is just south of Lyon. And in the Pila region, you have legends about how either Pilate was born there and or came after he fell out of favor. And that basically, there's even a story that there's one well where he allegedly committed suicide by jumping in that well because he couldn't take it. There are stories about a villa, a Roman villa, which was supposed to be connected with him. So it's not just the story of the family who went into exile, it's also some of the other players involved who have this French connection. And a French connection to this story isn't as if we're talking about aliens from Sirius or somewhere else landing in the Holy Land. It was normal for people to travel between the Holy Land and France in those days. And, you know, if you didn't want to do it by boat, there were various land routes through which you could do it as well. Another thing is what a lot of skeptics, or not so much skeptics, but people who want to explain the mystery of Mary Magdalene away, but in a slightly different way than just saying there's nothing to this whatsoever. People have been looking into some of the places like St. Baume and other places connected to Mary Magdalene in France, and they found evidence that there was temples to Venus, temples to other deities, but specifically Venus. And you can guess what the theory is, that basically a Venus sanctuary, when Christianity came, had to be explained away in Christian terms. And so the locals adapted the story and said, like, well, actually, you know, Mary Magdalene lived here. And then they point out the overlay between Venus and Mary Magdalene and kind of like explain that away. I think of what you were saying is about how these people were priestesses. I think, you know, the more logical scenario is that these people would naturally be attracted to sacred sites, become part and parcel of it, probably try to convert or integrate or whatever they did in those sites, and that you find that there is a quite straightforward connection, but a factual one rather than just a rededication from Venus to Mary Magdalene happening 3 centuries later than what it would have been in reality.
Well, I think you also have to ask yourself, why Mary Magdalene? You know, I mean, there is a reason that these places are rededicated to her. You know, why Mary Magdalene specifically? If she wasn't there, they could have, you know, made this. Why wouldn't it have been the Virgin Mary? You know, that's what Catholicism does later. Later on, Catholicism, particularly you see this in Ireland, everywhere, where all of the goddess Bridget Wells are now Saint Bridget's Wells, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All of the, you know, the ancient holy sites are now sites where there are statues of the Virgin Mary, and they've all been rededicated to the Mother of Jesus. So I guess my question in those cases are, in France, why didn't they do that? In France, why wasn't it the Virgin? And the answer is really simple, because Mary Magdalene was there, because her legacy is so extraordinarily powerful, that of course it was Mary Magdalene. And you know, I've had the real pleasure of taking a number of people to France over the last years, mostly Americans who were seeing it for the first time, into these regions, specifically the Southwest, but also through Burgundy, because Vézelay is very powerful with Magdalene energy and Magdalene presence. Wonderful town outside of Vézelay called Avalon. And so you can also ask yourself that question, you know, why is there an Avalon in France, and how does it connect to the Arthurian Avalon? And that's another story for another day. But I have had the real joy of taking people through these places, and not all of them were convinced, you know, prior to getting there. A lot of them were curious, they were open-minded, but they weren't necessarily convinced or committed to these ideas. And across the board, every single one of them just shakes their head and says, there's no secret, she's everywhere. She is everywhere. She is throughout France. She is so present, and there is so much evidence of her being there, in the art, in the architecture, in the etymology, the place names, everything, that it's absolutely undeniable that Mary Magdalene was an incredibly powerful figure in French history.
And I think one of the difficulties of trying to get it all straight is the fact that it is complex. She is everywhere, and one of the things I've always struggled with is how does Vézelay and Saint Baume interrelate? Because if you don't go there, you have this idea that she seems to have two bodies, which again, you know, you have the Egyptian pharaohs Nefru, who might have had three because there were three pyramids dedicated to him. So how does that compare with Vézelay and Saint Baume? Because both sites claim to hold the relics of Mary Magdalene. That's something which, if you haven't been to those sites or you haven't dug into the legend of Mary Magdalene in France, which I definitely felt was confusing. You need to get into the detail to understand how that works.
But also, you know, these places that claim to have her relics, the other thing you have to remember is they're not claiming complete skeletons. Okay, a skeleton has a lot of bones. I mean, for example, the relic in Vézelay, I believe, is one thigh bone and then a couple of other smaller knuckle, finger, whatever bones. St. Maximin has her skull and then has a couple of other bones. There's another thigh bone in St. Baume. So actually only a fraction of Mary Magdalene's bones are accounted for. So I think that's part of the confusion, is people say, well, how can her bones be in all these places? Well, because, you know, she was scattered. And you have to remember, her bones were considered incredibly valuable. And I'm not talking about just monetarily, although they would have been because of the pilgrims who would have been brought in to see them. But they're incredibly valuable spiritually. And they were believed to have had magical properties and healing properties, and people wanted to be in her presence. So they would have been split up. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, there were literal wars fought between these two regions. And essentially it was the Burgundians versus the Anjou family. I mean, there was an extraordinary battle that went on for many, many generations over who had the right to possess her bones and where they should be. The problem with history is that there's a lot of babies going out with the bathwater, and skeptics will just throw it all out. They'll say, well, we know all this stuff was made up in the Middle Ages. Well, yes, we do. But it doesn't eradicate everything that happened before that. So I think we have to be very discerning in where the information comes from. I mean, I certainly don't say that we accept everything because there's a lot of junk out there too, and there's a lot of late inventions, and now in the last, you know, 20 years, there's so much channeling, and there's all kinds of inventions, and we do have to be really careful in terms of what we accept. But all of that said, I will say, for me, beyond the archaeology, beyond the carbon dating, there is something that I feel when I walk into the crypt in St. Maximin. There is something I feel when I stand in front of that reliquary that contains her skull. I can't carbon date that. I can't authenticate it. I can't do anything with that that's going to make a biblical scholar happy. But when I stand in front of that, I know I am in the presence of Mary Magdalene.
And it's indeed a very powerful experience, and you can just imagine how people throughout the ancient ages have come to these subterranean chambers and have stood there, and it's just not us, the hoi molloi, the normal people, but it was also kings who came there. People have always come there in search of something, and I've always been transformed by that, so it's you feel attached. As a kind of like a final observation, with Mary Magdalene's bones identified, this really is something which the History Channel is probably very unhappy with, because there have been dozens of documentaries on the search of where Mary Magdalene in France would have been buried, and some of them made it to the History Channel, some of them have made it onto DVD, and to some extent the Da Vinci Code plays with this idea as well, that somehow we do not know where Mary Magdalene's bones are. But I think the most fundamental conclusion of all of this is that we do know where she is.
We absolutely do know where she is, and you know, so don't be led astray by recent documentaries that claim to have found a new tomb of Mary Magdalene, because it's patently ridiculous. I mean, there are certain things that we have to accept, and one of them is we know where her bones are. We have known where her bones are for about 1,700 years. They are well documented. There have been wars fought over them. These, talk about authenticated. I mean, these have been really, really well documented, probably more so than any other relics in the last 2,000 years. So, you know, very, very important to remember that there is an awful lot that we know. So this new modern mythology that's coming out of things like the Da Vinci Code, which all of a sudden just pretends like no one ever knew where her bones were, is a little bit shocking to me to this day. Every time I hear someone talking about, oh, well, Mary Magdalene's buried under the Louvre, I get a little bit speechless, which is rare for me, because I want to say, haven't these people done any research? It's all well and good to perpetuate a new theory, but you can't just completely ignore the evidence that's there. You have to address that evidence before you bring in something new. And that's just what it means to be responsible in terms of looking at history from an alternative point of view. So whereas you and I are alternative historians for sure, I think we both have a very strict code of when and where to accept evidence as new evidence.
And the good news is also that you can jump on a plane, a train, a car, or whatever, and go and see the relics of Mary Magdalene yourself, whether it's in Vézelay, St. Baume, or St. Maximin, just down the hill, or in some of the other places which have relics of her. With that, we have come to another end of the Spirit Revolution. You can find us on the internet, on bbsradio.com, thespiritrevolution.com, and this and all of our other shows are also available and archived on iTunes. We are the Spirit Revolution from Kathleen and I.
The truth against the world.